I'd like to welcome Suzanne York to Cowles Radio. Hello, Suzanne.
Hi, Arnold.
Well, Suzanne, you're with the Institute for Population Studies.
Yes.
On my shows, I usually see whose birthdays it is on today's date. And it just so happens, it's a total coincidence, maybe it isn't, but it is actually Thomas Malthus's birthday today.
Wow, no kidding. Interesting.
So I think you mostly know about him as one of the early, he was born in 1766, one of the first person who studied really population and population growth.
Yes.
So very salient. Thank you so much for the interview. Could you tell us something about the Institute for Population Studies? Can you give us some background on that?
Sure. Well, we often go by the name of our URL, which is howmany.org. It's a little easier for people to remember rather than the mouthful of the Institute for Population Studies. But we're a small nonprofit in Berkeley. We've been around for a few years. We focus mainly on education and advocacy around issues related to population, in particular women's empowerment and family planning issues, and often how population growth can impact the environment. So we have a youth education program that goes into local high schools and community colleges. Mm. We put on movies and host speakers, usually in the Berkeley area, and just try to get people talking about population, understanding that it doesn't have to be a taboo subject,
right?
That the more we talk about it, the more we can understand it and realize that we can solve some of the problems that we're facing if we stabilize our population. But as long as, you know, we frame it in a positive light and let people know that we're advocating for choice for people, they can decide the right family size for themselves and the right way that they want to live. But just to know the issues around family planning and consumption and population growth.
Well, what are the numbers? I mean, we are at 7 billion now and over?
We're over 7 billion now. We hit that mark in 2011. And the projections from the United Nations, at least, is that by 2050 we'll hit between 8 to 10 billion people. Mm. So whether we hit 8 or 10 billion, a lot of that depends on the choices that we make today. And that pretty much involves investing in family planning and women's rights and girls' education. If we do those kind of things, we could probably hit the lower number. If we don't give women access to health care and family planning services, we'll probably see the higher number, although nobody really knows yet. Those are projections, and things happen that we can't predict. But probably be 9 billion people by 2050.
Yeah, it's a good range indeed. Yeah, and of course you're tackling, some of the most sensitive areas in people's lives, in religions and culture. So, it's not an envious thing you're doing in a way.
No, it's challenging.
because that's it. You've got to be sensitive on so many different levels, I would imagine, when you're working in this subject, to be sensitive to those different cultures.
Absolutely. You have to be sensitive and willing to listen and be respectful, not just for other countries, but for people here too, and understand that we all come from different backgrounds and have different experiences, and don't make assumptions.
Which areas or which countries in the world are growing? I know, in Europe and America and North America, certainly it's, fairly stable, but, where is this amazing growth happening?
Most of the growth will be happening in sub-Saharan Africa over the next 30 or so years. So it's in countries like Nigeria and Tanzania and Ethiopia, Kenya, and just pretty much all of sub-Saharan Africa will be experiencing a lot of growth.
That seems incredible when you think there's such stresses right now with their environments and their economies in those countries. I mean, the Sahara's advancing, and how on earth can, even sustain it a few years?
Well, the people have been doing this for many, many years, and, and a lot of countries, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, are fighting poverty and inequality, which are huge factors on population growth. So if you're poor or you don't have access to, you know, social services and other things like healthcare, you tend to have more children because you're planning for the future. You may not have a retirement plan.
Right.
You have kids, right?
Right.
So, you know, a lot of those countries, they tend to have larger families for cultural reasons, definitely, but also to ensure somebody will take care of you when you get older.
Again, that's what you have to overcome, isn't it, in this process. Now, yourself, what got you into this this line? What is your background and learning from this?
Well, I've only been working directly on population-related issues for a few years. Before that, I really got involved with protecting the environment through fighting globalization, essentially the World Trade Organization, IMF, World Bank, and those kind of things, and the impacts that global trade was having on not just the environment, but on human rights and indigenous rights. So I did that for a number of years, and in 2009, I went to India on a Sierra Club study tour with their Global Population and Environment Program, and became very interested in the relationship between women's empowerment and population growth and how we are going to protect the environment and protect our resources for future generations. And kind of, you know, since then I've been working more and more on these issues.
I imagine it's a fascinating subject when you think of it. I mean, it's huge. It touches every life on the globe, obviously, and in every aspect of life.
Yeah, it affects almost everything, it seems like it. So, yeah, I can pull from experience before from the globalization field to, you know, learning about reproductive health that I didn't know very much about until a couple years ago. So,
okay.
Quite interesting.
It's interesting, you know, with all these facts and figures, it appears there's a lot of population deniers about the ecological threat that the population growth has. Can you tell us about that and what's happening? You wouldn't think that people would deny that the population is growing, but can you give us some background on that?
Well, there are some people that think, you know, there's a statistic that I think that the whole world could fit into the state of Texas. And, okay, well, maybe that's true, but what kind of quality of life are we going to have? And I think some of the deniers just look at it, not even from a human rights perspective, they just see growth as good. We're conditioned to think of growth as good, especially economic growth, and they just see more people as either more economic growth or just, you know, the more the merrier. I'm not sure exactly how they always come at the issue, but they don't want any restrictions on rights. And if you want to have, you know, a large family, of course, that's your choice, but they don't, a lot of these people seem to not care about the issue, and they just think, oh, well, this technology will save us, or, you know, we'll be okay. We can have 50 billion on the planet and that'll be fine, and not really thinking long term what that would mean for water usage and ocean, the fish in the oceans and the forests and, you know, quality of life issues.
Is that actually 50 billion is a number that they think is sustainable?
I don't know. I mean, I've heard different numbers. Julian Simon, he's an economist, I believe, that had a bet with Paul Ehrlich back in the 70s about how wrong Paul Ehrlich, the author of the population bomb, was. And he made some sort of bet, and I'm not really remembering how it goes, but he was saying that we would just extrapolate in our population until we could have, and it was some huge number, more than 50 billion, I think. And he was saying, oh, we could handle that. So, I mean, he was coming from kind of the Chicago school of business mentality that growth is good and, you know, why stand in the way of it.
Well, and that's it. And that's, they don't see the, I suppose, the end of things. They just, you know, oh, we'll always find another vein of ore, or it seems to have sort of blinkers on in terms of seeing that the end of things.
Yeah, I think it's like the climate issue. You know, as long as we're getting electricity, we don't really care if it's we're blowing off mountains to get the coal or building a pipeline through, you know, Canada and the U.S. for it. It's just, it's a really short-term mentality, and you think your life is good, so it's going to be great for everybody no matter what.
Right. Exactly.
Now, you have to ask them yourself to really know for sure. But
yeah, I have a feeling they don't even know. They don't even question somehow.
<No. laughs>
But, you know, obviously yesterday was the 1 billion rising.
Yes.
And very significant, obviously, in terms of women's empowerment, and that's something that you work on with the population control. Can you tell us how really women fit in and are so vital, obviously, apart from bearing children? How does that all fit together?
Well, really, when you empower women, you're empowering their families and the community that they live in. You know, providing them access to either voluntary family planning services or education and healthcare and economic livelihoods, it, you know, it changes the trajectory for not just one woman, but, you know, so many others that she comes into touch with. So, you know, looking at the 1 Billion Rising campaign, it's just a way trying to get people to understand not just gender violence, but empowering women, you know, can really change you know, society for the better. You know, you could provide health care and safe births, and you reduce maternal mortality, and that in turn that ensures greater child survival rates. So it kind of just starts the ball rolling for, you know, more good things. I mean, if you look at a country like Brazil, which has made tremendous gains in reducing its population rate, and it's grown economically, but it's also women have smaller families, and they're, because they're having education, their kids are getting educated, and there are more job opportunities. So it just kind of spirals out normally for the positive.
When we're mixing in, obviously, the growth in China and India, now, how is that? I mean, China, even though with the one child rule, obviously, it still has grown tremendously. Same with India. Do those numbers just swamp anything else you can almost do in terms of fighting it, population growth?
Well, interestingly, you know, China's population is slowing and aging now, so that's going to be a quite an interesting case study, I think, to be looking at over the years of how they are dealing with that part of the issue. I mean, the numbers can be overwhelming, but it's much more than numbers. It's about people's rights and the state of the environment, and, you know, finding a way to balance how we live and how much we consume. I mean, as China develops even more economically, they're going to have more middle-class consumers, and that's going to put more stress on the planet. But then, I mean, it's easy to get lost in all of that, but there are also many good things happening on the ground, especially in India. I think that women are becoming more empowered there and taking charge of their families, and as they develop, you know, hopefully they'll, you know, pull back a little bit and not follow our path so closely. But for now, it, you know, it's anybody's guess what will happen.
Indeed, one hopes they can leap over where we're plodding in the mud with, and go better. Yeah, really.
They might. You never know. So.
Well, I hope so. You know, I mean, everyone's very bright and intelligent. They can look and see, well, that's really not working. We should do something different. You know, it seems logical. But when politics comes into it, obviously, that's a whole other thing. Now, how does it, with your work, how do you interact with politicians and policies? What does the Institute do with them?
We're not out actively lobbying, but we do advocate for increased family planning, especially for international or, you know, for foreign aid. We want to see more money diverted to supporting not just international family planning, but policies that support economic livelihoods for women and girls' education and, you know, economic empowerment. And that's abroad. And then in the U.S., it's more, you know, supporting something like Obamacare that's allowing for, you know, birth control to be covered under insurance for everyone. And you know, I was at a women's policy summit in Sacramento last month, and they were talking about reproductive rights and how it impacts low-income communities and, you know, things that I might take for granted, or a lot of us take for granted, just going to the doctor and getting a prescription for, you know, either birth control or anything that for some communities is very difficult. Either they can't afford it or they have to go very far. And so it's just improving the outlook for people here as well. So we just do a lot of education and, you know, suggest people support these policies, but not necessarily, we're not necessarily out on the Capitol telling them what to do.
Lobbying on that end of things. Yeah.
None. Not yet, at least.
So, yeah, so really raising awareness, keeping the information flowing, and being, I suppose, the clarion call, or there's another, the Herald or something.
Yeah. I mean, it's been such a difficult issue since the 70s. I mean, people became more aware about, oh, the population was really growing, and then it, you know, kind of went off the tracks because of China's one-child policy and sterilization in India and other countries. It, you know, became very controversial and people didn't want to talk about it anymore. And then you throw in something like abortion. So it can be difficult to talk about. And as you said earlier, it's a very personal issue. But I think, if, you know, as long as we frame it right and, again, just start talking about it, not telling people anything, but just talking about it, then it can, you know, hopefully grow into a, you know, a more mutual and beneficial conversation.
Well, indeed, I mean, obviously, during the Bush years, there was a great reduction in that information and flow and help around the world from American foreign aid because of their stand on birth control. How has that changed? Has it changed? And what is the policy now?
It's changed. There's something called the Global Gag Rule that was passed, I think, in the 80s under Reagan, that you couldn't, U.S. funds couldn't go to an organization that provided abortion counseling or provided abortions. So even if the organization was, let's say it was in India, was out there not just providing contraception, but health care and you know, education and a range of other opportunities, if they were counseling on abortion, they weren't going to get any funding from the U.S., you know, zero funding. So depending on the type of president, under Republicans, this global gag rule was in effect, and under Democrats, it would get rescinded. So it just keeps, you know, going back and forth every administration. And so Obama rescinded it again, and he's increased some of the funding to international family planning, and he's done a lot around women's issues. And of course, under Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State, she really put those issues out in the forefront. So it's been, the picture's been improving over the last few years, and it should for the next few years as well.
Yeah, we've got another few years. We'll see. Yeah, exactly. Who knows? So many crazy things seem to happen now.
That, who knows?
7 billion people, we're chewing up trees and ore and all those, and obviously the ice is melting. We've got quite a, you know, quite a confluence of things. I mean, and we're talking, you know, obviously trillions of dollars, most probably, for humans to actually reverse this because the amount of energy we put into making it. You know, is there one thing that we should be doing first, or is it really you've got to attack everything, or does it one thing make the dominoes fall?
Well, personally, I think you need to attack a lot of things at once. You know, a lot of people that work in this field definitely are talking about how family planning can, you know, stem population growth and thereby ease some of the climate challenges that we're facing and some of the other environmental challenges, and that's certainly what I believe as well. But I think we need to be tackling consumption right along with improving human rights for everyone, and especially women's rights. But the consumption piece is the one that's really going to be difficult, I think, to overcome, because we're so conditioned to buying and advertising, and, you know, that sort of lifestyle is just the way so many of us are. And, you know, I know better, and I still go out and buy stuff that I don't need. And, and I really know better.
Yep.
You know, one thing I've been researching recently is an emerging movement called Rights of Nature. Hmm. And it's basically not looking at nature as property. That's how we, for the most part, our society perceives nature as just, you know, property. And it's giving it, you know, rights in a legal system whereby, you know, not so much that an insect could take you to court, but that if there was an oil spill on the Gulf, somebody could sue BP on behalf of a, you know, destroyed ecosystem.
Mm.
So it's kind of that mentality. It's still forming. A lot of it's come out of the indigenous viewpoint, and trying to transition that thinking into Western thinking is a challenge. But, you know, we used to think slaves were property, and, you know, eventually they regained, mm-hmm. they gained rights, and, you know, women didn't have rights for many years and they got rights. So, you know, I think it's a different way of thinking, but it's something that needs to be explored more as an opportunity to, you know, protect, you know, we're part of the ecosystem. That's something we need to protect as well as protecting human rights.
Well, it's true. When you think of it, I mean, corporations are people. So if an inanimate object like that, I don't see why a natural object wouldn't be able to stand in court and have rights.
Right.
Seems pretty logical. But isn't that incredible? Now, obviously, you're not working by yourself. What other organizations do you work with or you know, do you support that keeps things moving in this area to get the awareness?
We work with Population Media Center. They're in Vermont a little bit. We work with Population Connection. They used to be Zero Population Growth back in the 70s.
Hmm.
They do a lot of youth education, so we've kind of modeled our program a little bit on their experience. And I volunteer with the Sierra Club's Global Population and Environment Committee, which is the volunteer committee.
Hmm.
And, you know, we work with groups locally for events, Earth Island Institute or the Ecology Center in Berkeley. You know, whoever we can team up with, we try to as often as possible. And, you know, always looking to explore new relationships, because sometimes it's easy to get stuck talking to the same people that think the same way as you. But, you know, for us, maybe we need to branch out a little bit more to the reproductive health and justice people so they can see our point of view around the environment and, you know, we can see theirs around reproductive health. Sometimes we kind of forget that, oh, we're all on the same side, but, you know, we work in different areas, so you kind of, you know, overlook that.
Now, Suzanne, do you have any other events that you plan or things that you support or promote that to help the awareness?
In terms of events, we don't have it quite scheduled yet, but we're hoping to work with an author of a book called Enough is Enough. It's about building sustainable economies.
Hmm.
The author is Rob Dietz, and he's with a group called the Center for a Steady State Economy in D.C., and he has a chapter on population and, you know, how that fits in with the whole economic growth model. It's a pretty interesting book, so we're trying to schedule that probably in late March. And that's it right now, I think, for events. And I just did a report late last year on people's rights, planet's rights.
Hmm.
It's holistic approaches to sustainable population. So kind of some of the things I've been talking about, rights of nature and women's empowerment and alternative economies are part of that. So,
Alternative economies, can you explain that?
Well, there's a lot going on around the idea of a new economy, something that's based not on, you know, endless economic growth, but, you know, not just a local food movement, but something along those lines of, you know, do we need constant growth? How do we, you know, pull back from that? And, you know, there's selective growth, that there are things that we want to grow in, and there's things that we don't want to grow in. And part of it's looking at new indicators of well-being versus just economic indicators like GDP, which count the good and the bad.
Mm.
But we want to promote indicators that, you know, are considering how happy people are and can we work shorter hours but still, you know, have a comfortable living. And there was something last year called the Degrowth Conference in Montreal. It's a movement that came out of Europe.
The Degrowth.
Degrowth, yeah. Okay. I'm not sure how well that name would fly here in the U.S., but a colleague of mine calls it selective growth, which is a little better. But, you know, it's just people thinking about how to live more sustainably, not to overuse that term too much, but,
right.
You know, I think there's a lot actually going on in your neck of the woods from, you know, Occidental Arts and Ecology Center and places like that that are promoting more community resilience.
Indeed, yeah. In fact, they hold our FCC license, the Occidental Arts and Ecology Center. Do wonderful programs and workshops, fabulous stuff. And, well, that's the wonderful thing about the Bay Area. Now, how far, just taking the Bay Area as sort of a watershed, as a an area, where are we in that process of being sustainable?
That's a good question. I think we're, you know, some places are definitely doing well, but we have a long ways to go. You know, communities are investing more in rail and, you know, public transportation and, I don't know if I necessarily want to say smart growth, but just planning with the community in mind, not just for growth's sake.
Right, right. Kind of the clusters around the transportation hubs and things like that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, I don't know. That's a really, you know, tough question. There's a lot going on, but it's, you know, piecemeal. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have cities that have climate action plans, and you have cities, you know, Oakland, I think, is trying to source, or maybe they've already passed it, you know, agriculture, all their agricultural needs must come within, I think it's 50 miles of Oakland, or a certain amount of their agricultural needs come within 50 miles. And, I mean, those kind of ideas are out there circulating, and some smaller communities have passed them, and others are, you know, exploring community gardens and rooftop gardening, not just farmers markets, but, you know, going past that as well. And
well, so, and obviously a lot of all this comes down to energy. that's a very sore issue with about everybody in terms of what, how we, where we get it from, and how we use it. What's your organization? What is your view? How are you looking at that solution, a bit of the big picture?
Well, we know that we're going to run out of fossil fuels at some point. Probably not in our lifetime, but, you know, again, it comes back to living, you know, not just within our means, but living lighter and not investing so much in fossil fuels. Excuse me. I mean, so much of our society is not in cahoots, but, you know, they are so influenced by the fossil fuel industry that it's hard to realize that, oh, there's more going into wind and solar that you don't often hear about unless you're actually an expert in those issues or interested in those issues. You know, we're just trying to get people to also understand the alternatives. You know, it does impact population growth as well. I mean, you know, our resource usage, especially in terms of energy. So it's trying to understand that the long-term picture and start investing in alternatives today, you know, more and more as we can. And, you know, pull back from fossil fuels because they won't be here forever. And I think we'll see some of that action this Sunday. There's the Climate Forward rally that's going on in D.C. and around the country. You know, again, you know, people trying to raise awareness that this is not the path that we want to take. We want to get off this path, and we do have alternatives, and it's not going to happen overnight. But, you know, if we start pushing this and making it a priority, we can change that, the way our society lives.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? When you're up against, you know, obviously lobbyists from, you know, energy and big agriculture and big pharma, it is very, very, very hard for smaller groups to, you know, get any word in there and to shift policy. So it sounds like it's just going to take a constant drumbeat, you know, in Washington to make them change. And how do you manage that, you know, with so many disparate groups?
I mean, that's democracy.
Yeah.
And, I mean, for it to work and for us to change anything, people need to be on the streets and they need to know the issues. And, yeah, it might take a while and it might take something bad happening to get us to change our ways. But, you know, if and until that happens, it's just, you know, word of mouth and talking to people and getting them to influence their policymakers. And, you know, other than that, there's really not that much you can do unless you're a billionaire.
Indeed, indeed. And well, why don't you give everyone your information out, because maybe they want to help and donate something to this incredible work you're doing.
Well, thank you. Yes, we have a couple of websites. Our main website, as I mentioned earlier, is howmany.org. And then I write for a blog that's connected through the howmany.org site, but you can go to populationgrowth.org.
Okay. And any other associations or groups that might be of interest to people on the subject?
Oh, wow, there's a lot of them. You know, in D.C., there's the Aspen Institute. They have a global health and development program that's doing some amazing things. They're looking, they work with leaders from around the world or former leaders like Mary Robinson of Ireland and actually the current president of Malawi. And then if you're interested from the environmental perspective, the Sierra Club has an environment program and the Center for Biological Diversity does as well. Yeah, like I said, Population Media Center, Population Connection, Population Institute. Most of those are in D.C.
So really, so people have no reason not to do something. There's people out there waiting for help on this subject.
There are, and yeah, they all have websites and are pretty good websites and are on Facebook and Twitter and all that. So whatever, you know, your favorite form of entertainment is, you'll probably find something on Population.
Well, thank you so much, Suzanne. Suzanne York of the Institute for Population Studies. I really appreciate the interview and fascinating subject and something we've really, it should be a priority.
Great. Arnold, thanks for having me. And yeah, thanks for making that a priority for your show.
Oh, a pleasure. Good luck with your work, Suzanne.
Thank you. Have a good night.